Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today is number one New York Times bestselling author, Susan Wiggs. She's been on the show a couple of times before, and I'm thrilled to have her back today with her latest novel. It's called The Lost and Found Bookshop. The story explores the meaning of happiness, trust, and faith in oneself. As Susan asks the question, if you had to start over, what would you do and who would you be? Well, yes, this is fiction, but it's also very timely because of the times we're living in right now. I know many of my friends and colleagues, myself included, are assessing their lives right now and asking how they can become more aligned with what they love and who they truly are and what they truly want to be doing with their lives as we move forward into a new normal. So it's always great talking with Susan, and today we cover a wide range of topics from story and character development to artistic expression and diversity and what kind of responsibility she feels around that. We also talk about how Susan kept going in the early days of her career when times got really tough, and how now she keeps moving forward through the midst of world chaos. I know many people have found it very hard to be creative or even to just focus on work projects. So, we're all kind of going through the same thing. Susan Wiggs has authored more than 50 novels, including the popular Lakeshore Chronicles series and the instant New York Times bestsellers Family Tree and The Oysterville Sewing Circle. Her award-winning books have been translated into 24 languages, and Susan lives up here in the Pacific Northwest with her husband on an island in the Puget Sound. Sounds idyllic, doesn't it? Her new book, again, is called The Lost and Found Bookshop, and here's my guest, Susan Wiggs. Well, Susan Wiggs, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you and hear your classy accent once again.
Well, I looked up, I thought, my gosh, it's been quite a while since we talked, and it was 2014, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, according to my records.
Well, we're only 6 years more fabulous, what can I say?
There you go. I love that, 6 years more fabulous. And a lot has happened, a lot is going on right now, but we're going to talk today about your July release of The Lost and Found Bookshop, which I love. And it's described by some as a novel, as a love letter to booksellers everywhere during a time when they need our support. And it's certainly a celebration of books and bookshops and booksellers and community. So would you tell us a little bit about the story here to get us started?
I started this book based on a personal fantasy of mine, and I think it's a fantasy that a lot of writers and book lovers have, and that is to own your own bookshop. I think from a very young age, I would picture what it felt like when I walked through the door and what the displays looked like, and you know, I had in mind this creaky wooden floor, and it was always just a lovely little personal fantasy. I wanted to live in a garret up above, and so finally I came to a place in my writing when I thought, you know, this is a really powerful fantasy for somebody, but it needed a story to go with it. And so when I started thinking about what was important to my life and what was relevant to readers and things happening in the world, I came up with this woman who, my stories always start with a moment of profound change in somebody's life. In this case, a woman who walks away from her corporate job and unfortunately brought about by a tragic turn of events, but she finds herself not only in charge of her elderly grandfather's care, but also in charge of a failing independent bookstore in San Francisco. And so once I had all those pieces together, I found a really beautiful way to turn this into a story that's full of conflict and drama and lots of tears and laughter and hopefully heartwarming moments.
Right.
And it was my entire life last year, and I never dreamed that the moment that it came out, independent bookstores would be front and center as places that were really, really heavily affected by the pandemic. And so I have a lot of affection for the bookstores that I, in my life and that I've known in my life. And so it really was, it's really kind of a interesting time to have this book come out and be talking about bookstores in general. I hope people are.
Yes, I mean, they were, you know, some of them were struggling before this all happened, and now, of course, it's just got worse. And I love that on your website you feature an independent bookstore, on a couple of them on your blog, because those are the places that when you're out on a drive and you come across, I see those as little treasures. I love it.
And thank you for stopping in. It's all too easy to dial something up on our phone. And so to take the time, it is a gift to yourself, to give yourself time to wander into a place and see what's out there. And it's a different experience, isn't it? I often go into a bookstore with a goal in mind, and I come out with not only, you know, what I went there for, but probably some other things as well.
Yes, I find that. I like to go and just browse. And of course, when the stores are open, they always know me because I'm in there so often just browsing, because I do get ideas from looking. And it feels like if I've had one of those special browsing times, it feels like I've had a mini vacation when I leave. So I'm very appreciative of bookstores, period. And San Francisco, what a perfect location for your story.
Well, one thing that I'm guilty of as a writer is traveling around with the settings of my books, but they're always set in places that I love or would love to visit, and so, you know, you'll never see, like, a grim and gritty, you know, urban setting for one of my novels, because I have to sort of virtually live there during the time that I'm writing the novel, and so I pick yummy places, you know.
Right.
Sides and beaches and lovely vintage neighborhoods in San Francisco. I really love San Francisco. I don't get there often enough, but every time I've gone, I've always had such a delightful time, and I just love it there. And so, and initially when this book was going to come out, I was going to have a book tour, book signing tour that started in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and that never did come together because nobody's able to schedule anything. So it's all virtual.
Right, right. And I know that's going to go up on your website if people are wondering how they can follow you around and maybe pick up some of those online meetings that you're going to be doing during your digital book tour. One of the things I'm always fascinated by, because I love research. I'm a right nerd. But I do love research if it's something I'm interested in. And you said you did an incredible amount of research for this. So what kind of research did you do?
Well, it had several branches, because there was the one storyline that was how to run an independent bookstore. And so that was probably my favorite thing to do, because I got to call booksellers. And you mentioned that on my blog, on my website, SusanWeeks.com, I have some conversations with booksellers, and there are more to come. Every few weeks or so, we're going to put up another one. And they usually came from conversations that I actually had with booksellers as I was picking their brain about what really goes into this bookselling enterprise, and what draws you to it, and how do you fit into your community, and what's important to you. And so I loved doing that. I did a lot of it virtually, but I visited a number of bookstores and just kind of chatted up the staff, and so the people in the Lost and Found bookstore are compilations, and they have, you know, some of my favorite traits of the quirky booksellers that I've met, and really lovely, well-read people. And there's, of course, a lot of things drawn from my own life that I didn't have to research, like the massive failed book signing.
Right, right.
That nobody showed up to. That one was, yeah, people are going to get a chuckle out of that one. But, yeah, and so I did that. I also researched what actually became a central theme in the book, which is elder care. You know, how do you honor the elders in your life when you're in charge of their care? What is that? How does that relationship grow and change? And what is it that, you know, you're called upon to do? And I came across a phrase, working daughters, because often it is the daughter who ends up being in charge of her parents' care later in life, and what does that look like, and how does that affect her life? So I did a lot of reading and listened to a lot of podcasts and TED Talks about that. And then the final piece was a historical foray into, believe it or not, the Spanish-American War in the Philippines, which doesn't sound like it has anything to do with the story, except there was a little nugget that I was reading about old buildings in San Francisco that survived the earthquake. And one thing that I found that sort of stuck with me is that when soldiers were being deployed to the Philippines from San Francisco during the Spanish-American War, 98-99, and they didn't have anywhere to leave their stuff behind, and so sometimes they would go to a saloon and they would hide it in a wall or, you know, some sort of little hidey hole in a floorboard. They would put things in there to be there when they got back. And so I became very intrigued by that idea. So one of the little elements of this book that was so enjoyable to me was the things that the building itself hides. And the building, it's called the Sunrose Building. My made-up bookshop is in an old building. And one of the treasure hunts was, you know, through this building as it's being renovated. And so that was really another piece of it. So I got to wear a lot of different hats during the writing of this book.
And do you do your research as you go along? Do you like to do it up front? You know, I talk with a lot of authors. They all have a different way of doing that.
I'm always convinced that other writers have the right way to do it, and mine is just like such a waste of time. But I always try to do as much as I can up front, because the more I know about my setting and the situation of my book, the richer the story becomes. But I always find myself, as I'm writing, I'm having to go look something up. And so I try to do as much as I can at the beginning as I'm planning the story, but I never quite know what I'm going to need. And so I end up having to procrastinate for a day and jump in the car and go to the library or go online or something just to find something out. And I love doing that, but it's not very efficient. I've heard that the novelist James Michener used to have staff researchers, and I always was intrigued by that, but I don't quite know what I'm looking for, and so I have to do it by myself so that I can figure out, you know, what I'm looking for.
Yeah, and I think often when you're doing your own research like that, it's burns ideas, because you kind of bounce around a little. You can kind of go down different rabbit holes and explore things.
But... Ooh, rabbit holes. That's a great expression. Yes, that very much describes it.
Yeah, I know. I don't know about James Mitch, and I've not talked with him, but I don't even know if he's alive, to be quite honest anymore. But is he still alive? But James Rollins I've talked with, and he just gives himself 6 months up front, and then it has to stop, and he does the writing following that. But I can see it bouncing back both ways. So let's talk a little bit about your characters. And Natalie Harper is your protagonist. And tell me how you worked with her, how she came to you, and how you developed Natalie.
Natalie is a character that's very... I have a lot of affection for her, and she strikes me, especially at the beginning of the novel, as a very smart yet incomplete woman. And I tend to research the character's backstory by thinking about what was their family of origin like, how has it built her into the person she is today. And so I was very fascinated by the fact that she grew up in her mother's bookstore. Her mom never had a partner and was always just a single mom, and granddad was this interesting and quirky old man. The bookstore started out as a typewriter repair shop, a typewriter shop. It was granddad's, and then, you know, as the computer age took over in the 80s, he and his daughter converted it to a bookstore. And so it's been in the family a long time, and that was really important to her. But what she noticed about it, and the thing that intrigued me about Natalie, is the impact of living an uncertain life when the economics, they never knew if they, you know, if they were going to make the rent that month, for example. And so the uncertainty in her childhood really led her to seek out stability and in her adult life. And that's where we meet her at first. And but I think when you, but she compromised something. She compromised a piece of herself that was, that really loved that life that she grew up in, but she didn't think it was sustainable because she was, you know, so addicted to being settled and predictable and things like that. So she went the corporate route. And so I enjoyed having her journey be, you know, from one of predictable, settled life into quite a lot of drama and chaos, and what ultimately developed for her. So that was her. I named her Harper, Natalie Harper, after my lovely publisher, HarperCollins.
Oh, God, that was a good shout out there.
The names usually come from somewhere. So I built that character based on a choice that I made back when I was a young writer, because when you're an emerging writer just getting started, people do not, you know, like to throw money at you for being an aspiring writer, that's for sure. And so there did come a time when, you know, I really had to, there was a time when I had to hawk my cello just to buy groceries, because I was a teacher, but, you know, on a teacher's meager salary, trying to raise my daughter, it was really challenging. And I did have an opportunity to move ahead in the world of education, or I was just starting to get my books published, and I could, you know, sort of follow that. And I came to a crossroads, and I did take a big risk, and I rolled the dice, and I you know, threw in my lot with a writing career, and thank goodness it worked out for me. But I just remember how scary that seemed to me, and how risky. Mm. So I was putting everything at risk just for this one dream that I had, and so I wanted to revisit that old self of mine, and so there's a lot of that in Natalie.
Yeah, I love that you said that. One of my questions actually was going to be, was there a time in your own life when you really struggled and thought of giving up writing? So you did not. I mean, you're 50 books plus, I think, now. So what was it in you that kept you going during that time?
You know, I have to go back to my family of origin. You know, my parents, I'm the middle of three kids. I, you know, grew up in the 60s and 70s, and my parents had a very, they were sort of forward thinking. They were sort of progressive for their time period. I remember my mother was a devotee of Dr. Spock, the child rearing guru of the 60s, and she was a teacher herself. And my father was a man who, he was a first generation American, and, you know, the first to go to college and have a big career. And in some ways, we're a very traditional family, but in other ways, we lived all over the world. And my parents raised me to simply not give up, and to not take no for an answer if there was something that I was after. And so I think that was really embedded in me from a young age. You know, just because somebody tells you no doesn't mean that you can't have it. You know, it just means you need to find another way to get it. And so I that was probably in the back of my mind. It certainly wasn't in the front of my mind, but it never occurred to me to deny myself something that was so powerful within me. And I do know, I've had a lot of discouragement along the way. I mean, every writer with a career of any length is going to tell you about the dark days, you know. And I think you just have to keep this kernel of optimism inside that what you're doing is right and you're on the right path. And believe me, it's, you know, I'm oversimplifying a lot here. I've definitely had my moments, but one thing that I hope that everybody embraces in their life is don't ever let somebody take your dream away from you.
Yes, I love that. And you say on your, I love that little quote you have up on your website. I think it says laugh, love, dream, something. Yeah. It's a great philosophy to have about life. And I think, you know, if you're lucky enough to have parents who raised you that way, and I was too, then it's kind of intrinsic to who you are at some point. It's just there. But that, as you said, doesn't mean it's easy. I want to just talk before I move on here. I wanted to, you just mentioned names, Natalie Harper, and the contractor in the story who plays an integral part. I want to ask you about him, because last time we talked, you said names are so important to you. You said it's like naming a baby. And his name is Peach Gallagher.
Peach.
And I know that you love Gaelic names from the last time we talked, but where did
Gallagher, his last name, Peach Gallagher. And, you know, that was one of those names that came out of my fingers. You know, I was writing down, you know, I'm writing along, you know, who are the people in this story? And I knew that she was going to need a renovation expert to help her with her terrible falling down, falling apart building. And that was one that I have no idea, you know, where it came from. And so it was a situation where I started with the character's name, and then I built the character behind that. And I thought, well, why would this big, brutish, you know, truck-driving, you know, nail-belt-wearing, tool-belt guy be named Peach? And so I thought, well, because he's from Georgia, and his actual name is Peter. And so I kind of built his storyline around that, and he took on a life of his own. He actually wasn't the original love interest in the story. The original love interest in the story was a different character who's still in the story, but they sort of switched roles.
Yes, yes. You said when you were developing the grandfather, Andrew Harper, or Grandy, as they call him, that your mum was quite inspirational in developing that character. How so?
Oh, so much so. Well, she lives in my town, and she lived in an assisted living sort of place up until actually a couple weeks ago, and she's moved to my home, and so now she's literally, you know, a part of my life every single day, which I love. She's 90 and has multiple health issues and is a bit high maintenance, but also I've noticed that our relationship has definitely evolved in nice ways. I mean, there are challenges, of course, but in ways that you think you know somebody. You know, she's known me all my life, and we're still, you know, every once in a while, we're still discovering something. You know, she told me the other day that she studied education in college, but her true passion was for meteorology, and she really wanted to be a weatherman. But back in the 50s, women didn't become weathermen, and, mm-hmm. and that was just a little thing I never knew about her. So I've had a lot of affection for Grandy in the story. He's a very different person from my mother, but I liked illuminating that relationship with somebody at that point in his life and with those challenges. My mom has early dementia, and as does Grandy in the story, and he has some other issues as well, and I just wanted to really illuminate and portray that commitment and the intimacy of that kind of relationship.
Yeah, and it comes across, it's so special. You mentioned the Philippines earlier, and I won't give it away, but I love the scenes where they're together going through photographs, and I just was so real. I really like those scenes. So I think that question also is something that everybody should ask their parents. What would you have done if, you know, the sky was the limit? Because I think it really tells you a lot about them. I asked my mom that several years ago, and she's gone now, but, you know, several years before she went, and she said, instantly, I would have been a professional athlete. And I was like, whoa, where did that come from?
It's a remarkable thing. And I think we don't ask enough because we're so used to the people in our lives. I love coming up with a fresh, challenging question like that. I think that could lead to some really good conversations.
Yeah. I want to talk a little about, if we can, Susan, about artistic expression and responsibility. And, you know, we're obviously going through these times right now with the pandemic and the political situation and the protesting that's happening as we speak. And I'm wondering, and I've read a blog post that you did, which I thought was really well thought out on diversity, because there's been a tremendous amount of talk about how people shouldn't write about other people if they're a minority group, but to me that's kind of like an actor should be able to play any part, and really a writer, if they do their research well, should be able to write any part. How much responsibility do you feel as a writer?
So much more now than in the past. In the past, it was something that it really didn't even cross my mind. And it's because when you write a novel, you write about a cast of characters, not just one character. I can't imagine myself writing the main character as somebody other than a rather, you know, familiar ethnic group, my own. But I couldn't imagine writing a book that didn't feature people of color and people of different, you know, sexuality and things like that. And so I feel like I really, you know, I don't want to compromise my expression of my worldview, which is, you know, a diverse world. And certainly in the Lost and Found Bookshop, you're going to see that. And the reason that I wrote that blog post, Diversity in the White Writer, was that I did hear from a reader of color who had some comments about a book that I had written, and there were two expressions that she kind of pinpointed, and she said, "You don't understand how this lands with a reader of color." And I was really moved by that, and I actually had the publisher change the boilerplate of the book so that in future editions it will be different. And they were things that never even crossed my mind, and so I was really grateful for that. And so what I'm doing going forward, and thank you to both of my publishers, they're both with HarperCollins, one is Mira Books and the other is William Morrow Books, they have sensitivity readers. This is a new piece of publishing. Somebody will read your book with an eye towards racial, economic, and sexual sensitivity, and try to, you know, make sure that something doesn't land. So in the Lost and Found Bookshop, it features some Asian American characters, Chinese American characters, and so someone from San Francisco who was Chinese American read it. And I loved her feedback. There weren't things that were offensive, but there were a couple of things that I wrote that were just flat out wrong. Mm. And so she made some corrections for me. And there was another, can't remember. There was another book that was read for me by a sensitivity reader, and there were a couple corrections to be made. And so that's how I'm trying to take care of my responsibility with my publisher. But I can't imagine, you know, just turning my back on writing about diverse characters just because I'm not diverse, you know.
Right.
So I love our world. I love the vibrance and diversity in our world. And so I'm, you know, certainly committed to, but I do want to write about people in a respectful and responsible way as well.
Yes, I love it. And, you know, I've interviewed nonfiction authors who also have sensitivity readers. I'd naturally never heard that until I interviewed somebody, and her book was entirely about camel's milk.
Wow.
And she had a sensitivity reader for that. And I was like, well, I've not heard that before. You live and learn. And so real quick, how have you coped creatively? You said you spent all last year working on the book, but I assume you're working on your next project now. How when everything is chaos around you, how do you find the wherewithal to focus on your work, Susan?
It's challenging. I literally, you know, you mentioned before we started this broadcast, you mentioned that you had to take a break from your phone and the news feeds on your phone. It's just an act of will and self-discipline, and I'm really bad at it, and so I've had to be really, really focused. I try to, you know, often I'll write with headphones on and just white noise, and I just try to block everything out. And one of the things that I do that turned out to be probably very helpful in this time is that I write all my first drafts in longhand on paper. So that takes me away from the digital world, which is a huge distraction. So I do that, but I wish that there was an easy magic pill that I could take to kind of block everything out and focus solely on my story. But the reality is, you know, real life is right in our faces, and it's something that, you know, I guess I have to make my peace with it and think that, you know, the work is going to get done.
Yes.
I've done it before 50-something times. I quit counting. And I'm going to make sure that I do it again. My readers keep me going, too.
Yes, and I know you're very active on Facebook. You have a great support on there. So I know listeners can find out much more about you at susanwiggs.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Susan?
I would love to leave your listeners with just a reminder that anywhere you buy a book is fine with me, but this year maybe make a little special effort to visit an independent-owned bookstore and see what they have to offer as well.
I love it. Susan Wiggs, it's always such a pleasure. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I hope to talk to you again soon.
And we will be back next week. You can find out much more at Susan's website, as I said, at susanwiggs.com. You can find us at conversationslive.net. If you have questions or feedback on today's show, that's where you can go to send that to me, conversationslive.net. All right, we'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.